This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in now with Morton Marcus, who's an Indiana economist, writer, and lecturer, about some of the recent Eye on the Pie columns that he puts out there. You can catch them online, of course, too. The Howie Politics website has many of these out there, as well as all around Indiana, including local newspapers, too. And as always, Morton, thank you for joining us on the program today.
My pleasure, sir.
Well, let's start in with the latest missive you've put out there, talking about being able to put the information together on cities and towns and make it available. And I guess from what you say, that it kind of started out with a conversation that you had with Northern Indiana mayors over in Logansport not long ago. Tell us how the conversation switched over and got into focusing on population and what the size of a community has to do with what happens in the community.
Well, I think it's very important that we recognize that our communities are suffering from decay. And I tried to point out that it's not really a universal issue. We do have lots of communities that are growing. It's mainly the smallest communities that aren't growing. It looks like about, I'd say about one-third of the communities that are under 5,000. And it's amazing how many communities we have in Indiana that are under 5,000. The data that I saw shows that there are more than 450 of these places that are just very small. And, we, of course, we've got them right here in Lake County and in Porter County, and it's not just in the rural areas. We've got some really small places I think New Chicago would be one of them, that just don't have very much population. And then the question is, well, what can people do if you don't have much of a population base? You're not going to have much of a tax base. And you're going to end up with a situation where you just can't afford to do many of the things that a larger city could do. And it's one of the reasons that if we're going to keep small places, we're going to have to recognize that they're really going to be burdens on their neighbors in some respect. Then we've got some small places. A place I live in Marion County, for example, has only 1,600 people. It has no commercial base. It's purely residential.
Yeah.
And should that be considered a town? Sounds like my dog back there was trying to get in on the conversation.
Well, he probably had something to add here, you know. Well, I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you don't think of Marion County, which is basically the city of Indianapolis, as having small communities in them. But you're right. Your community is one of them. Isn't much bigger is Beech Grove, which is on the southeast corner of the county.
Right.
And it's another community. And these are all, I'm sure they're all towns at one time or another. When Indianapolis used to be constricted by the city limits, that that were thriving in their own way, but things changed and Indianapolis swallowed them up. That is turned into basically Marion County.
Well, no, what happens is that many of them wanted to be separate from Indianapolis. That's the other thing. They were residential developments where they said, well, we can't put up a wall, but we certainly could be separate from the city, and we've allowed that in Indiana. And once a town is established, you've got problems. Look at the problem you got with Griffiths, for example.
Yeah.
They don't want to be in North Township. They don't want to be in Calumet Township. They don't know where they want to be. And there's some question that anyone of the townships wants to take them. We're coming to a point where we're going to have to reconsider our local governments and what they can do. And rarely do they even want to cooperate with each other. I don't know if you remember, not too long ago, Munster and Highland were talking about having some cooperative arrangements on, I think it was the fire department.
Yeah, certainly. And in Public Works, they talked about that for years, about combining the Public Works departments in Highland and Munster. And they may actually be closer to that, judging by even just as recently as what Mayor Tom McDermott has said about wanting to find a location to put in a new convention center. It would be possibly in the same area that is part of the very north edge of the town of Highland. So there's some land that's available out there for different things, too. Do you think that that maybe it's, of course, the lawmakers will probably hate to bring this up. It's not a very politically wise thing to bring up. But do you think that maybe the legislature has to consider how to redo the annexation or consolidation laws, maybe to try and take some of these smaller communities and make them into bigger ones?
Well, that's one way, but what happens with the legislature is that they generally take power away from the localities and make their own determinations. I think that I do not see the legislature as being friends of our cities and towns. They generally will make arguments that are much stronger for the rural areas. It's a very tough situation. You know, there's an interesting political fact. This is just slightly off the subject here. But no mayor in Indiana has ever been elected governor. Now, we've had some pretty prominent mayors in all parts of our state, and yet, and I went back to about the founding of the state, back in the early 1800s, and no mayor has ever become governor. There's been, they may become U.S. senators, like Senator Lugar, but none of them have ever become governor. It just suggests a lack of statewide support for people from the cities. We think of ourselves as a rural state, but, you know, most of the people live in incorporated places, even if they're very small places.
One of the columns that you had out here lately, in fact, just a few weeks ago, talked about the labor force, and you offered up a number of happy items and some questions that kind of followed here. And some of the happy items involve the unemployed latest list, I guess, for Indiana, going back, and how many counties seem to have seen a decrease in unemployment. Tell us about that column and some of the things that you brought up about that, and some questions that seem to arise from the happy points, so to speak.
Well, we do have good news over the past year, as does most of the country, about unemployment. The unemployment rate has either dropped or stayed low, and the number of counties that have really seen some improvements. I don't recall in detail. I was trying to look on my computer, Chris, and the cat has walked across the, you know, this is one of the problems of working at home. He walked across the keyboard, and right now my computer is, I would say, having digestive problems.
Well, you're just lucky you could get to the keyboard that the cat wasn't sitting on it. Ours sometimes do that too. We have to shoo them off the computer all the time at home. So for the reason. So, I know that you talk about the fact that, you know, that we have many counties that have seen the number of unemployed decrease. Only four counties, and we're talking primarily ones that seem to be within central Indiana, if not around Indianapolis. They're not very far away. I take that back. There is one exception. That's Porter County up here in northwest Indiana. Most of them seem to be located in central Indiana, to be sure. They've seen the unemployment increase there, but it's not by very much, I guess. And I guess
what it is, I think, is that those counties are attracting people to move there because they've had such good growth. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a strange kind of thing that happens in statistics. But if you get a lot of people moving in and they haven't quite found a job yet, they can be counted as unemployed. But it's because of the economic strength of the county, because so many people do have jobs in those counties. So those counties attract people who are not unemployed in the sense that they're getting unemployment compensation, but they're looking for a job. You know, there may be relatively young people who've gotten out of school recently and they move to Porter County because they know there are good jobs over there, or they move to some of the counties around Indianapolis where there are good opportunities also, and they end up being counted as unemployed even though the following month they may have a job. So you can get that kind of effect. I think it's all part of the general improvement in the economy of the state.
One of the points that you mentioned in that particular column you talk about, and it is maybe something that that we ought to look at, we've focused an awful lot on a particular county or a number of counties' unemployment rates and the changes that happen because of that, and because of the way that the labor market seems to be these days, that maybe we should look at more at a statewide basis rather than on how different each county or counties might be.
Oh, yes. Yes. You know, we have so many people in Lake and Porter County who travel elsewhere for their jobs. And then we have people from outside Lake and Porter County who come in to those counties to work. That you can have a situation where there are lots of jobs in the county next door, but it won't show up as a job in that particular the county where they live, so that people will say, well, we don't have the jobs here in this county. Well, they're right, but there are jobs next door, and the whole question may become one of transportation. And transportation systems are very important, and one of the things we suffer in the state of Indiana has been for a long time that we just don't have the transportation network to get people to work. And the problems that we have in Lake County in getting a even decent bus service in many, many areas of the county and in Porter County as well is to me a real inhibiting factor. People who don't have a job very often can't afford a car. They can't get a car because nobody will lend them the money for the car because they don't have a job. And that is very bothersome to me, that people very often, even if they do have a job, if they a job where they have to walk to it, and they may walk a mile and a half, and people say, well, when I was a child, I could walk a mile and a half. Yeah, well, that's all well and good. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily healthy or convenient. We really need to think about transportation. One of the solutions, of course, is trying to make money available as a loan for people who want to buy a car. And there's no public program that tries to help people get a car in that fashion. It's possible that the car dealers could come up with something that didn't have an exorbitant interest rate on it that is designed specifically for people who are currently unemployed and they just need a car to get to work.
Well, Morton, we have just a few minutes left here, and there was one column in particular I'd like you to talk a little bit about. It was from earlier in the year, and it deals with robocalls. Like we all get them. Usually we end up sending them to the caller ID part of our phone, and then we can delete them that way, but we still have the phones that keep ringing. And tell us about the concerns that I guess we're trying to get the Attorney General to make some changes to cut back on the robocalls.
Well, we have these do not call lists, and they seem not to work. I know that around 5 o'clock in our house, our cell phones and our landline start ringing quite a bit. It's a nuisance. It's a distraction. It's an invasion of privacy, and I just don't think we should allow it to happen. I think the idea of people who are making these calls, they must be making money out of it. In many cases, there's a lot of fraud and scams that are advanced in this fashion. Some of them are worthwhile charities. Some of them are not. And I think we have to find a way of making sure that we just don't have people making these calls. And the government and the phone companies, I think, could do a lot. on this basis. I know that the technology is difficult for me to understand, but I think that calling companies certainly have a way of identifying where these calls are coming from and putting a stop to it. And I just feel that the law enforcement in this area is very weak. It's something that we may have to kick up to the federal level, but I think we ought to be making a real effort to put a stop to the telephone home invasion.
Well, Morton, these are great ideas to talk about, and we're glad we had a chance to cover a few of them today, and we'll be checking back in with you to get some more of your thoughts and the look at the economics of Indiana and other topics, too, on the Eye of the Pie columns that come out here. Thank you for being with us to talk about what we're out there today.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thanks for calling.
And you're welcome. We've been talking with Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Students these days have access to technology, to information, to opportunities like they've never had before, but they also have, unfortunately, levels of stress and anxiety and depression that have never been seen before. Well, that's the topic for this month's column from the guest coming up. It's Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and she's joining us from Indianapolis. Tammy, thank you for being with us today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, where was the information come about here about something which is alarming, I suppose, maybe to some, but not to others?
Yes, you know, and I think we're hearing more and more. It came to our attention because of so many educators and after-school providers saying, gosh, our kids are really, really stressed out. And that's showing up, you know, and sometimes teenagers, it's hard to tell what's normal stress and what's concerning stress. And we're definitely hearing that it's turned more to things such as, you know, kind of that concrete anxiety and or depression, and sometimes it shows up even as far as suicide attempts and those kinds of things. So it's something that we need to pay attention to and that we know that teachers are paying attention to, as well as our State Department of Education.
Well, I was going to say the State Department of Education has got some information that's come out here recently and talking about suicide in particular. Some of the things I note that they have said are not surprising. They've said this before, but they seem to be reinforcing the stats. Tell us what you've learned about it.
Yes. So right now, suicide is the second leading cause of death for Indiana youth ages 15 to 24, and the fourth leading cause for those ages 5 through 14. So that means 1 in 5 Indiana high school students, which is approximately 200,000 of our kids, have seriously considered or attempted suicide in the past year. So that's startling numbers. And, you know, I think the more we understand that, the more we know them, the more we're encouraged to do something about it.
Yes, certainly. How about the problems that they're facing in schools, too? And I know it even goes, I guess, as an end result, as far as students being either suspended or even expelled from school.
Yes. You know, it makes sense that kids who are scared, afraid, or stressed out or have high anxiety levels is going to cause disruptive behavior. That often shows up as disruptive behaviors. And so what happens more often than not is sometimes the disciplinary techniques might actually further that negative impact inadvertently. I mean, we know that kids who are involved in the disciplinary system are more likely to drop out. They're more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system. And really, it's how do we make sure these kids feel safe, supported, and secure in their school setting? Unfortunately, we also know that school suspensions in school and out of school are disproportionate many times based on a child's race.
Now, there obviously are some encouraging signs. Where do you, with the Indiana Youth Institute, see these signs coming, and do we still need to do more?
There's always more to do. Yeah. You're absolutely right, Chris. I think what we're really encouraged about is that the Indiana Department of Education is really stepping into this space in a very thoughtful, evidence-based way that is going to be widespread. So they have come out with a new tool, the social and emotional competencies. They're all available on their website, the Indiana Department of Education. And it's really going through and training on things such as self-management, relationship skills, responsible decision-making, self-awareness, all of those things that the more we understand and the better as educators and youth workers, we all can provide those skills and teach those skills and model those skills, the more it will address some of these needs of our kids.
Now, we know that the Indiana General Assembly has put in some additional money to handle things like school safety. Are these measures, at least the opportunity for the measures, helping out as well, too?
Absolutely. It's a really wise investment because we know that for every dollar invested in programs such as the new one that IDOE is rolling out, it returns $11 in savings, most acutely from the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system, but it also results in higher lifetime earnings and increased mental and physical health. So, again, this is a really wise investment on the state's part, and that being said, it's also going to take a while. It's not easy work, but it's worthwhile.
Now, obviously, we still have a General Assembly session that is underway. In fact, they haven't even really taken up much about the next two-year state budget. What do you folks with the Indiana Youth Institute encourage lawmakers across not only Northwest Indiana, but the rest of Indiana do to make sure that the next two-year spending plan that is going to be set up is going to provide enough money to keep the things going for schools?
Right. We're always talking about the wise investment that centers around our kids, right? Every dollar that we're investing in our kids is setting our communities and our state up for future success. So, you know, whether it's right now we're talking a lot about children who are being impacted by the opioid crisis. If we don't address not just the adults that are struggling with substance use disorder, but also the kids that are in those lives, we're going to have a long-term problem, right? So a lot of the kids' solution, a lot of the kids' planning and the child investments that are being made today, we're going to see the results, and or positive or negative, over years to come. And so we're always encouraging lawmakers to understand the data, understand the challenges, help us. We're happy to provide that data and access to that data and even some analysis of it. You know, what does this mean? What does it mean? Right now, we know that some of our child hunger numbers in the state went down, and so we have less food insecure kids, but we also have more kids that are overweight and obese. So what does that mean, and what do we do about it? And, you know, we're always encouraging them to think deeper and to get real numbers and data so that we can serve our kids.
Now, we've only had a chance for a few minutes here to talk about some of these important issues and the updates, of course, too, that have come out from the Indiana Department of Education. If people are interested in finding out more, either getting caught up with the latest info or just the basic issues as well, too, how can they find out now?
Everything is always available on our website, IYI.org. The whole data book's there, the whole outline of this column and what it means for the social and emotional competencies from IDOE. There's an outline on our website, and then there's also a link to DOE, their full curriculum. So, and if you can't find it there, give us a call or shoot us an email, and we'll see what we can do to connect you with the information that you need.
Well, Tammy, thank you very much for talking about this today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana libraries want to block a bill that is moving its way through the General Assembly right now that could lead to their budgets and even their tax levies being taken over by a town or a city or a county council. And as a result, a number of library directors made a trip to Indianapolis late last week for a hearing to consider the bill, to talk about it at least. No action taken, we understand, at the hearing, but that doesn't mean that the bill's dead. And we'll find out more about it from our next guest in the studio with us to talk about the problems, I guess, that the community faces in trying to fund a way to put all those books on the shelves. We have with us in studio the CEO and the executive director of the Lake County Public Library, Ingrid Norris, with us. Ingrid, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, the concern, I think, is probably one that is more of an education probably to the average citizen and the average taxpayer as to really what do public libraries financially live on as far as the rest of the pie is concerned, and how in turn this particular bill would make some big changes if it should happen to become enacted into law. Tell us a little bit about without getting too wonkish, I suppose, about the structure of how the financing for public library systems happens in Indiana.
Okay, currently, the Department of Local Government, we submit a budget. They tell us what we're allowed to levy the taxpayers for, and on average, in Indiana, we get about 4 cents for every dollar that is collected. Most of the money goes to school and county and city government. So we advertise our budget to the public. public have a chance to come in and give us their opinion on that. We cannot go higher than what, if we go higher than the Department of Local Government tells us, we actually do have to go with what's called binding review, which means our fiscal bodies, such as the county, would approve or disapprove whether we have the ability to increase our budget. Mm-hmm. So what this bill would do is say that all budgets that we submit would have to go through either the county or the city. So, for example, Hammond would go through the Hammond City Council. So with the tax caps and the circuit breaker, that's a little unnerving because of the fact that everybody's scrambling for money.
That's right. I mean, we know for two, we've talked before and had conversations before talking about the problems that the public school districts in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular are going to face when the tax caps pop off in 2020 and try to figure out how are we going to survive with a reduced amount coming in from property taxes. To be sure, it's not going to be any easier for the public library districts either, is it?
That's correct. And in fact, public libraries are getting hit even at a greater rate with the circuit breakers than any other government agency. There's been some studies that show that public libraries are going to have even more of it, have a bigger impact with the tax caps than the schools or the towns or the county government. So.
Now, there is a difference that maybe most people don't recognize or be even aware of in how the tax levies are set up for public libraries and with other units of local government. So we're talking about towns, the cities, and county government, too. What is the basic difference between the two? How do libraries and how they work differ from just your average city governments, we'll say?
Well, the public library is not allowed to levy for, say, a capital improvements money. So the libraries have both a rainy day fund and then they have a library improvement reserve fund. To be able to fund those, we actually have to be frugal and mm-hmm. we have to, at the end of the year, whatever money we are able to transfer that money to one of these two funds. Then if we need to, for example, I have 9 buildings. So there's HVAC systems, there's repairs. That money comes from the money that we have saved over the years to fund those. Every other government entity, schools, county, police departments, you know, all of those entities have a CUM fund, which means they can actually levy taxpayers or assess taxpayers' money to be able to fund those. We have to, in general, have to be frugal so that we can save basically for rainy days.
Now, going back in time, when the Lake County Public Library System decided that they needed to expand the Central Library in Merrillville and add on the space, there were just not enough shelves, space for all the books and other items that were there, and do some shifting around. How did that major project get funded?
We actually went out for a bond and went through the whole legal process, and we received a $30 million bond, and we built new buildings, we renovated all the other buildings, and actually we, because of the tax caps, we refinanced that bond so that we could pay off early the bond so it wouldn't, when the tax caps in Lake County take effect, Lake County Library will only have one more bond payment in 2020.
Wow.
We specifically did that so that, because we knew that was going to come under the tax caps, and so we felt it was fiscally responsible for us to do. So we double paid the bond a couple of years, and then we also refinanced to a lower rate. So that is because of Larry HF, our former director, that he realized, he looked to the future and decided it was the best. So our bond is actually going to be falling away in 2020, and that's because of the work that we did.
Now, how do you think the Lake County Public Library System fares in that respect compared maybe to others around the state in other cities like Fort Wayne or South Bend or Indianapolis even, with maybe the same kind of debt load that they're going to have to deal with?
Well, actually, for us, we don't know how it's going to fare because we overlap 41 other entities. So all the debt that is with those other entities will impact our budget because with the tax caps, there's only so much money. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know how we're going to be. we think we may lose $1 million in our budget just because of all the other debt that is still out there in Lake County. So all we just have to wait till 2020 and see.
And find out. And that's unfortunately, they put you, I guess, in the same boat as the towns and the cities, the townships in particular, and all the public school districts out there, too. They're waiting to find out what impact the dropping of the circuit breaker for Lake County is going to have here now. In looking at this measure, and we should mention, too, that if you want to look it up and find out more, the bill probably itself doesn't tell you much, but the bill is entitled House Bill 1343. And it is now, as we said, it's in the Senate. It's made it over to the Senate. In fact, the Senate Local Government Committee had the hearing last Thursday in Indianapolis that you and a number of your colleagues attended to talk to the lawmakers on committee about. With this intent of trying to find a way to restructure library budgets so that they would come under the supervision, however you want to put it, of a town or city or a county council, do you think that maybe there are some library districts or library operations elsewhere in the state that might be in worse shape, and in turn they were the ones that might be that was the intent of the people that are drafting the measure to bring them under control?
Well, I think there is a little bit of a misunderstanding, because the library that actually triggered it did have a cash reserve, and so they specifically lowered the amount of money they were collecting from the taxpayers to pay down that or to use the reserve. And once they had brought it down to a reasonable level, they went back to their allowed tax levy. So if you look at, you know, the what it looks like on the internet or on Gateway, which is the thing, it appears like they dramatically increased their budget. They didn't. They just went back to their original, what they were allowed. So, but there are other libraries. I think I have a good relationship. We have a good relationship with county government. I think the other libraries are concerned because there's an inherent bias that the ones that could profit from reducing a library budget, because they would obviously get more money, they're going to be the ones that will be able to decide. And the way it's written now is up to 10% a year, mm-hmm. annually. In 10 years, we could be at 25% of our budget.
So there are concerns, and maybe not necessarily in Lake County's case, but some county out there with a very ambitious city council or county council will take a look at this paperwork, see how the budget is structured, and they'll sit and kind of smack their lips, especially if they see a big number in that reserve fund in particular. But there may have been a reason for that particular library system to put that, make sure that number is in there, because they've got some big work that'll have to be done eventually. And because we've done all of our big work earlier, we don't have that much problem to worry about these days now.
I think that's a good synopsis of the problem that, you know, like I said, we're doing fine in Lake County. Our board is engaged. I think part of the problem is, too, is they believe that because it's an appointed board, they shouldn't have the authority to levy or ask for taxpayer money. But I think that's a slippery slope, because there are other appointed boards that manage money. And if you go down this path, then economic development board, you know, there's other appointed boards that could be at risk if this bill goes through, because it's appointed boards. There's a reason for appointed boards.
Do you think that in this case in particular, and having a chance to talk with your colleagues in particular here in Lake County, of course, Renee Greenleaf is the executive director of the Hammond Public Library, and she's expressed some very real concerns about the fact that maybe if this bill becomes law, that particular councils, whether in this case in Hammond, the city council may want to be able to use some of that reserve money that in turn she's been trying to hang on to, because she, like you say, it may be a case where the heating and ventilation air conditioning system needs to be replaced, and you can't take that out of the tax dollars. You got to find other ways to pay for it.
I think that's a real concern across the state, because when a county reaches the tax cap, the taxpayers wouldn't basically it's redistributing the pie. So rather than getting 4 cents to the dollar, what they're doing is putting that money back into the tax circuit breaker fund, and it basically would relieve the stress on other agencies. So whether they wouldn't really be able to take the money, but they would be able to put it back in the pie and be able to redistribute to, you know, the county and the schools would have the biggest. But again, when you only get 4 cents to the dollar, putting that money back in the pie is like putting salt in the ocean. It's not, it would have a dramatic impact on a library, but the other agencies, it wouldn't even move the dial for them. So I think it's kind of, you know, when you're so small to begin with, libraries are not going to solve the circuit breaker issue. Our money isn't going to have much impact. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in this case, if you're looking statewide here, because there are concerns about library systems that are having problems or could have problems if they're not careful in the future, that this need to be able to take over control financially is something that has libraries worried, and in particular, libraries that, like I said, are kind of looking over their shoulder, not only looking at who's going to take over them as far as the money's concerned, but also, too, to help get the services done.
I think right now we have the law is in place that the county government can, if right now we have libraries that as they come together as a town and say, okay, we're hitting the circuit breaker, and they all work together between schools, towns, and talk about how are we going to deal with it. If for whatever reason a library decided to go and decide, you know what, we're going to do what we're going to do, there's a mechanism in place because county government, for example, at Lake County, 4 of our appointed board members are from the county. Mm-hmm. So if the county says, you know what, you need to reduce your budget, and because we're all doing it, if we said, nah, you know what, we're just going to go off on our own, they have 4 appointees that they could just say, you know what, it's in the law, we can reappoint different people that are willing to play ball and they're willing to listen to reason. So there is a mechanism in place, and it has been used with other libraries. So I think the mechanism is in place because they appoint our we have 4 from the county and 3 from school boards, and other libraries have had their appointees reappointed if they weren't happy with the way they were engaging with their counties. So I think the law is in place, and that's kind of what I testified when I testified in Indianapolis. There's already a law to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of collateral damage if you try and fix one problem and then actually break the system.
Well, now that this bill has come, at least through hearing, it's still in the Senate and has yet to come up before the full Senate for consideration. House Bill 1343 has been, I guess, judged by some as that, at least in its current form, is not workable enough to maybe to get passage or maybe even to come up for a vote. Even though you're a librarian and not a legislative specialist, do you think that's the impression that you and your colleagues get, that this bill maybe this year might be dead, and at least it's going to have to be really, really seriously reworked before it comes back up?
Yeah, I think that's the impression I got from the committee meeting, is that the way it reads now, which is that the county or the city could ask for binding review or supervision, mm-hmm, of the thing, and there was enough holes in it that I think there are enough legislators said there's too many holes, there's too many gaps in the bill. So I would say that we're watching it, that we're not going to believe that it's dead. And if it comes back up for testimony, there will be librarians that will go back and testify. So we're hopeful, but we're not. But we're still going to watch how it's tracking.
Well, there's still about at least a month left in the General Assembly session till the end of April. The budget for the next 2 years is still working its way through the individual houses that got out of the House. It's now over in the Senate being looked at, or will be, I'm sure, very soon. So that there'll be opportunities, if it's not going to get changed this time, that maybe this could still come alive in 2020, I suppose, which would just be unfortunate for us here in Lake County, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, with the perfect storm, 2020,
to be
in
sure.
Lake County.
Yeah. Well, Ingrid, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this, explaining what the general financial situation not only is for the Lake County Public Library System, but how public libraries in Indiana get their money and how they have to keep track of it, and how having a specific bill become law ordering that the general, I guess you could say, of financial bodies, the fiscal bodies, I guess is the word I'm looking for. In this case, talking about town councils, city councils, county councils, they're responsible for money within their own particular local jurisdictions, but how they take on library system on top of that, it'll be interesting to see what does come about here. Thank you for spending time with us to go over this and try to get the rally the troops together to get people who are supportive of the not only the Lake County Public Library System, but all the others here in Lake County and the region to be ready for something that may come out for this. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Ingrid Norris is the Executive Director and CEO of the Lake County Public Library, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Spring is just around the corner. Soon, summer will be in the sights of Northwest Indiana residents. The season's changing, and one strong indicator of that is that the Ravinia Festivals announced their upcoming season. Wells Kaufman is the president and CEO of the Ravinia Festival, and he was speaking recently with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about the 2019 lineup of stars.
So it's great to talk to you once again, Wells. It's a great time for you. Tell us what's coming up in your upcoming season.
So many wonderful things. Over 75 debuts and premieres. We're continuing our extraordinarily successful celebration of the great American musician Leonard Bernstein. We've got Morrissey and T.I. coming for the first time. We've got Pentatonix and Sarah McLachlan coming back. We've got Sting. We've got Nickelback. We've got Tony Bennett, of course. We've got Lionel Richie for the first time. For the Stonewall 50th anniversary, which is 2019, we've got the wonderful jazz pianist Fred Hirsch coming for the Martin Theater, and we're bringing back Considering Matthew Shepard, the piece that was written to honor the murdered kid from Wyoming. The 20th anniversary of that murder was last year. We did the piece at Ravinia. We're bringing that back this summer because of the Stonewall anniversary. We're also bringing back Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which truly, Sharon, in my decades of working in this business, which I've loved every minute of, and I've been around great performances and great artists, I've been lucky. Nothing ever that I've ever touched has had the impact of this particular piece on audiences at Ravinia. With continual emails, phone calls, texts, I see people at other concerts. They tell me how great that performance was way back in July. So we're bringing that back as well with the same cast, same production. So many people heard such great things about both these pieces, Mass and Considering Matthew Shepard, but they missed them. So we thought, you know what, let's bring them back. Why not? We love to be able to take care of our audiences in whatever way we possibly can. We got lots of great kids shows. We've got great chamber music. We've got a commissioned piece from the late, great Andre Previn for Renee Fleming in the Martin Theater. On and on and on. So many terrific things. Kesha. We're doing the movie Coco with live orchestra, as well as Ghostbusters on the waterfront and West Side Story. We've got Jennifer Hudson as our gala soloist. For the first time, she's singing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Lots of thrilling things.
That sounds like quite a list. You've been busy over the winter.
It's been busy, yeah, you know. But I'll tell you, it's because of the media. It's because of people like you, Sharon, getting the word out. When that happens, what happens is the agents and the artists hear it. And that's where you start getting buzz. That's where, you know, we didn't really have much of a country list, for instance, at Ravinia when I came. And it's music that I grew up with and I love. So the way that happens is you get somebody like Carrie Underwood to come, right? Then everybody takes notice. So this summer, we've got Lady Antebellum coming for the first time. We've been trying for them since their first hit record. And we've got Sugarland and Little Big Town coming. That's a viral thing that really the media helps out with in so many different ways. Common came a couple years ago. This year he's coming back with Queen Latifah. That's because of that first appearance that he had, even though he's a Chicago guy. He had never played Ravinia. So that's how these things happen, and we're very grateful for all of our partners, such as yourself.
Thanks so much for that, and I really appreciate it. It's great how those things just kind of take on a momentum of their own.
They do. It's like a, not an avalanche, that's a bad word, but it is sort of a snowball kind of effect where people start to take notice, and then you start, and then, of course, once you get the artist, you get the audience, right? And that's the really exciting part, not just from a box office point of view, but to make sure that Ravinia really lives up to its mantra, which is something for everyone, right? All audiences, all ages, all backgrounds, all neighborhoods, everything.
That's really cool. And you got some other really cool new features at the park, a new rooftop club, and an immersive experience center?
We do. We do. And I would love to give you all the details about the new experience center, which we're calling the Ravinia Music Box. But actually, I'm just doing the show right now. I can tell you that it's going to be completely teched out. I can tell you that it's going to have a museum component in which will be the 100th birthday museum exhibit that the Grammy Museum put together about Leonard Bernstein, which has already been in D.C. at the Kennedy Center, in New York at Lincoln Center, at the Skirball Museum in L.A. It's going to go to Vienna and Paris and London and to Chicago to come to Ravinia. So all summer, people will be able to celebrate and enjoy that.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that maybe I have not asked you about that's coming up?
Just that the pricing for all of our classical music continues to be the lowest in the country by far, especially for a great symphony orchestra like the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but also our chamber music and recitals. We've got, really do have something for everyone. We've got this, I'll leave you with this one because I'm excited about them. There's a group from Europe called Stile Antico. This is a group that does medieval and Renaissance vocal ensemble music. Sharon, they sing like angels. It's incredibly beautiful stuff. It may be something that people don't think they really want. It's too churchy. It's too religious. It's just beautiful. And in our stunning Martin Theater, that concert in June is going to be very, very special indeed.
That sounds really great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thanks for the conversation as well.
Absolutely. Can't wait, Sharon. Thanks so much.
That's Wells Kaufman, the president and CEO of the Ravinia Festival. And other groups and artists, by the way, coming to Ravinia during the 2019 season include Ringo Starr, Sting, Counting Crows, the Steve Miller Band, Michael McDonald, and Chaka Khan, and a lot of others, too. It's time for Eye on the Arts, and with today's conversation, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And Kirk, we are coming up on our final classical concert of the season. And this will be our third concert at Living Hope Church on Taft Street in Merrillville, just north of Crown Point. And this is going to be all French music.
Yes.
And this concert.
Mm-hmm.
Ravel.
Bolero.
Saint-Saëns. Okay, well, tell us about the pieces
sure.
you're going to be
well,
performing.
Well, people have asked me for the bolero for 2,000 years. You know, will you play bolero? Will you do bolero? Will you do bolero? And so we finally have a chance to program it. It's an expensive piece because there's so many. Just yesterday, we hired the saxophone soloists, which are not easy to find, even in a great city like Chicago. So there's all these different solos, you know, from... but it's a fantastic and exciting piece, and I'm glad that I can finally do it for the patrons who have asked me over and over for it. It'll take you out, so to speak. The outside of the program are two Saint-Saëns pieces. One is the Saint-Saëns Second Piano Concerto with Winston Choi, who is one of our favorite soloists in great demand in Chicago and the head of the piano department at Roosevelt. So that's one of the Saint-Saëns pieces.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece is the organ symphony, so-called because in the last movement of the symphony, with a huge orchestra on stage, the organ enters and it really just blows the entire orchestra away. And because with modern technology, you can actually have a big, nice Hammond or something organ. But with the way the speakers are aligned, it sounds just like you're in Notre Dame.
And so it sounds like a pipe organ.
Oh, yeah.
Living Hope Church does not have a pipe organ.
No.
Most churches don't have them
anymore.
No,
you will feel like you are in, you know, a big cathedral in France
yeah,
with
how cool.
some 32-foot pipes getting at you.
Which yeah. is what he wrote it for.
He certainly did. He blew everybody away. And we're very fortunate. I've done this piece with another orchestra, with John. John Scherer is the music director and the organist at 4th Presbyterian downtown, where they do have a monster
oh, sure.
organ, you know. And it sounds fantastic. It's just so exciting.
So he gets to play that mm-hmm. all the time. But then when he makes these guest appearances and with various orchestras, he doesn't necessarily have that kind of an instrument to play.
No. Well, but actually it's interesting. I think the instrument that we will rent, it will be the same as what they use at the Chicago Symphony when they're not using their entire pipe organ. Yesterday, mm-hmm. I went to hear the Mozart Requiem with Maestro Muti, and they used that same kind of organ that we're going to use. Of course, it's much quieter because it's Mozart. But it, and all Winston and John will be there at the pre-concert with me. Mm-hmm. They want to greet everybody. And I'm going to have the snare drum player from Bolero come in.
And you know, he's going to demonstrate.
Yeah, because he has to play the same thing for 14 minutes.
So he might as well warm up with the pre-concert lecture.
He might as well warm up. Yes, exactly.
We talked last time you were here. We talked a little bit about our new quarters at the Living Hope Church, and that there's a great space for you to do the pre-concert lectures.
Beautiful.
And great space for the Cookies with Kirk portion of the evening afterwards.
Yes.
So lots of space for people to socialize. And then the beautiful, really truly beautiful auditorium. And the seats are so comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
No seat is very far from the stage at all. It was a real find for us to be.
They did a wonderful job. All the things that they changed and revamped recently in the hall, and even things that they did on the stage to help us feel at home and have a beautiful acoustic. It's a beautiful and intimate place for us to come together and make music.
Yeah, well, it is, and we're very grateful to that congregation for welcoming us and accommodating us.
Yeah, new home.
Yeah. So next year, all of our concerts will be held at Living Hope Church, and we're glad to have everything in one place.
Yes.
So people they get used to where to park and where to enter.
And it's right in the middle of our region, I think. I mean.
Oh, no, it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like just as the Star Plaza Theater was in the middle and Bethel Church was in the middle, so too is Living Hope Church in the middle. So it is. It's perfect for our audience as well. Kirk, thank you. Good luck with the concert. Looking forward to hearing that tremendous organ piece. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And can you hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow's guests on our program include Indiana political analyst Brian Howie.